Background to Galatians chapter 3, verses 6 to 9. The 10th talk in a series on Galatians was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 22, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 5, translation, installment 3, and handout number 6, 3 arguments, accompany this talk.
We return to our study of Galatians. If you're on the email list, you got two handouts, okay. One is the next installment of the translation, and the second handout, I'm not really going to be looking at that today. I may never look at it here. That's for you to kind of peruse and study and digest. We're entering into the primary argument of the book of Galatians with this verse today, and he starts off with a very complex and kind of subtle and difficult argument. So what I've tried to do in that handout is, I'm going to go over all that in the teaching here, but I've tried to lay that out in a kind of careful, detailed outline form on that handout. So that's just for your enjoyment if you have trouble sleeping or something. So that's for you. We're going to look at the translation. However, we probably won't get to Galatians today. We're gonna go back into the Old Testament and look at all those passages that he quotes in his argument and understand how he understands the Torah. I'll explain all that in a second. But here's the passage we're going to look at. It will probably take us a couple weeks to finish this, maybe more. But this is what we're up against here. This is in chapter 3, verse 6 in your normal Bible, or paragraph 12 in my translation. I'm reading from my translation. Just as Abraham believed God and it was credited to him, resulting in dikaiosune, so then you should understand that those who look to find acceptance by reason of their belief, these are the sons of Abraham. Now the scripture, foreseeing that God would decree the Gentiles to chaos by reason of their belief, announced the good news to Abraham in advance, saying, "In you all the peoples will be blessed." The upshot being that those who look to find acceptance by reason of their belief are blessed with the believing Abraham. Now, however many there are who look to find acceptance by reason of their doing what the covenant requires, are under a curse. Indeed, it is written, "Cursed is everyone who does not continue in all the things written in the book of the covenant to do them." Now that no one is decreed to chaos in the presence of God on the basis of the covenant is evident, because the one who is to chaos by reason of his belief shall attain life. Yet the covenant is not excluded by belief, rather, the man who does these things shall attain life by them. When he became the curse on our behalf, the Messiah bought us our freedom from the curse presupposed by the covenant. Indeed, it is written, "Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree." As a result, the blessing of Abraham comes to Gentiles who are in Messiah Jesus. As a result, we receive the Spirit's promise through our belief. Okay, this is an incredibly dense but incredibly powerful passage. There's arguably there's no more important passage in the whole New Testament, because he just sort of packs in here and densely, concisely explains to us what the whole thing is about. This is the gospel. This is the story. This is God's agenda. This is God's project. So to the extent that we understand what's going on here, we understand the core of Paul's gospel. So this, I don't, it's worth taking a little bit of time on. Just briefly reviewing in Galatians, he started, this, as I say, is the body of Galatians. This is the primary argument beginning right here. What has he been doing up till now? As by way of introduction, he has made, he's trying to defend his right to, he's trying to defend his gospel against the alternative gospel that he sees being offered by the false teachers among the Galatians. And he made 3 points in that introduction. He made the point that in his ministry, he's not trying to impress men and win men, and he's not trying to market his teaching to men. When he says what he says, he's just being faithful to serve God. That's his agenda. He has no other agenda besides that. Apparently, his opponents are accusing him of prettying up the gospel for the Gentiles so that the Gentiles will bite. And Paul is saying, no way. I'm just telling it straight, giving the gospel that I received from God, and I'm faithfully serving him by delivering what I received. Then he has a long section saying, in fact, I didn't learn my gospel from any other man. I got it straight from God. Now, we discussed at length what he meant by that. What he meant by that is it began with an actual supernatural revelation in which Jesus appeared to him, and that blew his whole world apart, and it required him to go back and rethink everything. But then what he did is go back to the Torah, go back to the scriptures, and study with a new thought in mind that he had never had before. Jesus, the one crucified by the Romans, really is the Messiah sent from God. So with that in place, he goes back to try to make sense out of the Torah. How do I make sense out of the Torah if God sent a Messiah who got crucified by the Romans? How do I put those together? And in the process of putting that together, he came to understand the gospel of Jesus, the Messiah. Well, because he was going to Scripture to find that, he doesn't hesitate to say, I got that from God. That was deriving it directly from God, not some other human being. So Paul is not a fact, does not represent a faction within the church. Paul is not the inventor of Christianity. Paul is not some renegade rabbi just making junk up and causing trouble. He's faithfully serving God by teaching what it is that in his mind he has received directly from God. And that most of what we were talking about is centered on that. And then the last section we looked at is the last point that he makes in the introduction. And you Galatians, he said, you should know that. You should know that what I received is from God, because God sent his Spirit among you, perform supernatural works among you in connection with my teaching. It wasn't in connection with the teaching of people coming along telling you to obey the Mosaic Covenant. That's not when the Spirit was poured out and you saw miracles happen among you. It was in connection with my gospel that you saw those things happen. God was credentialing the gospel that I was delivering to you. So you ought to know that. You ought to know that my teaching was from God. So that's what we've looked at so far. Now he turns and with a bang, he opens up his argument for his perspective. Now, what's the issue again? Paul is going to make an argument for his claim that in order to be authentic disciples of Jesus, Gentiles are not required to keep the law of Moses like Jews do. They don't need to be circumcised. They don't need to keep the Sabbath. They don't need to keep the dietary regulations. All those things that are distinctive among Jews, Gentiles are not required to do those things in order to be a bona fide, authentic disciple of Jesus. You can be a bona fide, authentic disciple of Jesus and be a Gentile, live like a Gentile, look like a Gentile, and not be distinctive in any ways whatsoever from the Gentile culture. It's perfectly all right. Well, that's what he wants to argue for. So what he has to do is go back and make the case that that follows from what the Torah itself teaches, or the Tanakh, the entire, what we call the Old Testament. His rather complex argument centers around two parts. The first part is to argue that it's those who believe the truth regarding Jesus who are, and I'm using scare quotes here, who are in Abraham, and therefore who will inherit the blessing that was promised to Abraham. That's going to be the first part of his argument. Who is it that's in Abraham? Those who believe the truth about Jesus. And then the second part, he's going to contend that no human being will ever be granted life, the blessing of Abraham, because he deserves it. That no human being gets it because they deserve it. Obviously, he's making an exception of Jesus. It will be granted to him only as an act of divine mercy. So anyone who ever gets eternal life, the blessing of Abraham, is given eternal life, the blessing of Abraham, by the mercy of God, not because we've performed well. And what is it that qualifies, if you will, or makes it, identifies a person as someone who's going to receive that mercy from God? It's a person who's connected to Messiah Jesus. So it's our connection to Messiah Jesus that indicates that we are a recipient of the mercy of God, not our law obedience, not our obedience to the covenant. Okay? So that's what he's arguing in the second part. And those basically divide up between paragraph 12 in my translation and paragraph 13 in my translation. Okay, so that's where we're going. But in order to do that, it's not obvious what Paul's reasoning is in this section. You can't just read the section and read right off the surface of it what Paul's argument is, because he never really develops any of his arguments. He just asserts them. He just alludes to them. We need to reconstruct the argument because he didn't do it for us. Probably he's made these arguments a dozen times while he was among them, I would imagine. And so he doesn't altogether feel the need to spell out the argument in full. He just needs to remind them of arguments that he has already spelled out to them. That bad for us, probably good for the Galatians, but bad for us. It puts us in the position where we need to go back and reinvent what Paul himself discovered. I think in all likelihood, the arguments of this section are at the core of what Paul discovered when he went away and rethought the Torah after Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. I mean, these are the very key points that he discovered that changed his whole world and changed his whole perspective. The biggest mistake we make is not understanding how subtle and detailed and complex Paul's actual argument is. So we read something like his quoting Genesis 15, Abraham believed God and it was credited to him, resulting in dikaiosune, or as our English translations typically have it, Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. And then we just make stuff up. We just assume we understand what he's talking about, and we say, well, see, Paul says that that means the Gentiles can believe and be in Jesus and be saved. How on earth would you ever look at Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness in the context of Genesis 15 and conclude that? No way in the world would you and I conclude that looking at Genesis 15. Because what we're looking for is a straight line deduction from that assertion and Paul's conclusion. But Paul doesn't mean that there's a straight line deduction from that assertion to his conclusion. There's a lot of steps in between. And most importantly of all, he doesn't really mean that Genesis 15 implies that the Gentiles are going to be reckoned to chaos by their faith. That's not what he means. Genesis 15 doesn't teach us that, but Genesis 15 in the context of Genesis 12 through 22 does. In other words, we have to take the whole account of Abraham, everything about it and everything in it, and understand it the way Paul understands it, and then Genesis 15 is going to strike us as having some significance. In fact, as having the very significance that Paul underlines here. But there's no way in the world we would understand it to have that significance if all we had to go on is that one bare assertion from Genesis 15, 6, I think it is. Just on an aside, therefore, when we misinterpret Paul in that way, then we start, and you see all kinds of Bible teachers doing this, then we start to, we think, imitate Paul. And the way to study the Bible is to read a verse in the Bible and then start making junk up and make it fit your theology, make it somehow your theology be supported by that. Because and then we'd point to Paul and say, that's what he did. Well, he didn't. And let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he's a much more incisive, insightful, intelligent student and not a simpleton. Because if his conclusion can be dismissed as just being simple-minded and absurd, then we don't understand it. And so we have to be patiently look at it more carefully and longer and stay with it until we understand where he might be coming from and what he might actually be saying. So that's what I want to do, is go back to the Old Testament now in Genesis and some of the prophets and Leviticus and the other things that he quotes and some things that he doesn't quote, and reconstruct what it is that Paul is thinking. So I'm not even going to deal with the text of Galatians today and maybe not part of next week. We're just going to look at the passages that he quotes and make sure we understand those in their context. So we start with not the one he quotes, Genesis 15, but let's go back to Genesis 12. We have to start there. What's happened in Genesis before, you know, the flood, a turning point in history. There was the past age before the flood, and then a whole new age of history is introduced once mankind is destroyed and God starts over with one family and builds mankind up again from one family. That introduces a whole new age of human history. And we are a few generations down from that by the time you get to Abraham. But smack dab in the middle of that history, God comes to this man who at that time is named Abram, who does not live in Israel but lives in the end of the Mesopotamia, the valley, the mouth of the rivers in Mesopotamia. Now Yahweh said to Abram, "Go forth from your country, Mesopotamia, and from your relatives, and from your father's house, to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, this is the core promise, and it happens right from the get-go with Abram. This is the core promise that God is making to Abram. I want to analyze it here. I would argue that he's promising him three things. I will make you a great nation. I want to take a little time and talk about that. I will bless you. I'm going to take some time and talk about that. And third, I will make your name great. Those are basically the three promises. I will make your name great. Then he elaborates on a little bit. How is it that you're going to make my name great? Or how is it is he going to make his name great? Because he's going to make Abraham a blessing in that everyone who blesses him will be blessed, just as everyone who curses him will be cursed. And in fact, it's in Abraham that all the peoples of the earth will be blessed. So Abraham is a huge big deal because he's sort of the fountainhead for everything that God intends to do to bless a certain segment of mankind. It's in Abraham that they are going to be blessed. And who's going to be blessed? The ones who are going to be blessed are the ones who bless Abraham. And all of that's working toward making Abraham's name great. Abraham is a big deal. All right. So let's back up and look at those. I will make you a great nation. Now that gets developed throughout the Torah, in Moses and in the Mosaic Covenant, Deuteronomy, it becomes very, very much a part of Deuteronomy. The prophets then begin to talk about it. In fact, I would argue, the more I look at the prophets, it seems to me that this is the focal point of most prophecy, is the making of a great nation of Abraham. Now, what is he talking about? You know, for years and years and years, for decades, I just kind of looked past that. I didn't know the prophets. I didn't know the Old Testament. I was struggling to even understand the New Testament, and I hadn't even understood that yet. I would look at, I will make you a great nation, and I just assumed that was like Christendom, right? The Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants and, you know, that's a lot of people, a whole lot of people. They must be the great nation that he's talking about. It kind of subtly bothered me that you would call that a nation. How is that a nation? But, oh well, you know. I trained myself to allow myself to kind of play fast and loose with the language of the Old Testament, which was a big mistake. It means what it means. It means what it says. The way Paul ultimately understands this, and Paul's not alone, the Judaism of his day, probably all the Pharisees of his day, Phariseeism of his day, they understood what that meant. What God had promised is that this people, which had really humble origins and had survived a whole lot of persecution and warfare and defeat and exile and everything that they suffered, had somehow survived. And what had God promised them? Even though you've spent your whole history under the thumb of one Gentile or another, the day is coming when the whole world will be under your thumb. You will have the ascendancy. You will be the nation that is in control. It will be Jewish hegemony in the world, not Gentile hegemony in the world. That day is going to come. Well, that's what God had in mind with Abraham from the very get-go. In time, in my own way, I am going to make you a great nation. That has never happened in the whole history of the world. Never have they been a great nation. So obviously, it's something that awaits us in the future. And then all of a sudden, Revelation and prophecies in Isaiah and Ezekiel begin to make sense. the day is coming when we now know when Jesus is placed as king over the kingdom of Israel. In that day, Israel is going to be a light to the world, and they are going to be a powerful nation, an influential nation that basically reigns over the whole world politically and culturally and arguably militarily, in a sense. Well, that still awaits us in history. It has not been fulfilled, but it will be fulfilled, and that's what God had promised Abraham right from the get-go. I will make you a great nation. Where I really triggered my understanding of this was a passage in Deuteronomy. I'm sorry, I don't remember the chapter, but he's talking about what's going to happen if you keep the covenant that God made with you, and what's going to happen if you don't keep the covenant. He says, if you don't keep the covenant, all the nations around you are going to be the head, and you are going to be the tail. And I think that's just simply a metaphor for the power imbalance. The Gentile nations around you, they are going to have the power, and you're going to be subordinate to these powerful Gentile nations that are around you. They will be the head, and you will be the tail. But if you keep my covenants, he goes on later in the chapter, all these things are going to happen, and one of the things that's going to happen is you will be the head, and all these nations will be the tail. Well, the day is going to come when the people of Israel, under the leadership of Jesus, the Messiah, they are going to keep those commandments and covenants and statutes in the Mosaic Covenant. And when they do so, according to the promise of the Mosaic Covenant, they will be the head and all the other nations will be the tail. So I think that's what he means by a great nation. It's a nation that is the head rather than the tail in global politics. Okay, that's the first promise he's making to Abraham. I will make you a great nation. Well, there he's talking about Abraham's, the ethnic people that are having their origin in this man, Abraham. There's a whole ethnicity that's being spawned here from this man, Abraham, and it's that ethnic people that are going to be formed into a great nation. In other words, what we call the Jews. Second thing he promises him is, Abraham, I'm going to bless you. Okay, it just bugged me for years. Okay, you're going to bless him. Little red sports car, boat, a yacht, airplane, what are you going to bless him with? He doesn't say, just says, I'm going to bless you. Again, it wasn't until I was studying the first part of Genesis a little bit more carefully than I had ever studied before that I realized, look how prominent within the first 11 chapters of Genesis, look how prominent is the idea that mankind is under a curse. Mankind, by his very created nature, is subject to the curse of death. Adam and Eve proved that they deserved death, just as God had tested them and found out, in the day that you eat from this, you will surely die. They proved themselves worthy of death, and then you have these predictions by God about what's going to happen. All of them are presupposing you are a wicked and depraved race, species of being, and you deserve nothing but destruction and wrath from your Creator. You deserve to die. You don't deserve to go on living. Well, it's against that backdrop that God is coming to Abraham and saying, Abraham, I'm going to bless you. Well, what else could he mean, really, in this context, except the opposite of this backdrop that has been so vividly painted for us in the early part of Genesis? It's the opposite of death, of condemnation to death. It's victory over death into life. And that explains then why Paul so readily and easily, and Jesus too, everybody in the New Testament, so readily and easily connects the blessing of Abraham with eternal life. I think because they are just rightly understanding the promise right at the get-go. That's what God meant. That's what he was talking about. Well, Abraham, I'm going to give you life beyond the grave. Death will not defeat you. Okay, I'm going to make you a great nation. I'm going to give you life beyond the grave, what we call eternal life. And I'm going to make your name great by making you be the touchstone. You, Abraham, are going to be the touchstone of who else is going to be blessed with the blessing that I'm going to bless you, and who is going to be denied that blessing. Who is it? Those who look at Abraham and honor him for his relationship with God, honor him for his response to God's promise to him, honor him for his obedience to this God who revealed himself to him. If you honor him for that and seek to imitate that, you will be blessed. If you call him stupid for what he did and dishonor him for who he is and what he did, then you're going to be cursed. So Abraham's response to the promise of God, that becomes kind of the template and the touchstone for all of mankind after him. Imitate him, and you will be blessed in the same way that he's blessed. Reject who he is and what he did, and don't imitate it, and you will be cursed. But everyone who's going to be blessed will be blessed because they're imitating him. That kind of makes him a big deal. It makes his name great. And then we come to the last part of that, which becomes very important in Paul's argument. He says, I'll make your name great in that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. I think most of us Christians at one time or another, in fact, there might even be translations that translate it this way, take it, and by you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And I just remember in Sunday school knowing that, well, I know what that's talking about. Abraham had a great, 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 great grandchild named Jesus who brought blessing to all the families of the earth. So that's what he's promising Abraham. You're going to have a descendant who's going to be the source of blessing to the earth. It's not the way Paul takes it, not at all. He takes the word be in Hebrew not as by, but as in, as our New American Standard translates it. And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed. And he interprets the in. The question is, what does it mean to be in Abraham? What on earth does that mean? Well, it's apparently a kind of an idiomatic phrase where you're describing someone's the family that you are from, the family that you identify with, the family that you belong to, the people that you belong to. To be in Abraham is to be a child of Abraham, to be a descendant of Abraham. That's why when we get to Galatians, he's going to go back and forth, just without explanation, between being in Abraham and the seed of Abraham, and being a child of Abraham, and being in Abraham, and so on. Why does he use those basically interchangeably? Because that's how he's interpreting this passage. To be in Abraham is tantamount to being a child of Abraham. Okay? And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Okay, now we have this really, really cryptic, weird, self-contradictory promise. What do you mean, all the families? I mean, unpack it and realize what he's saying here. By being a part of your family, every human being, even those who are not a part of your family, are are going to be blessed. You see the tension and the contradiction. Who's going to be blessed? People who are not part of their family, who are a part of his family. They're the ones who are going to be blessed. Well, obviously, you can't both be a part of his family and not a part of his family unless being a part of his family is not a literal biological designation, but somehow a metaphor. So, and by being metaphorically your child, Abraham, all those people who are not biologically your children are going to be blessed. So their connection with you is going to be such that they are, in a sense, metaphorically speaking, your children. Well, by being your children in that metaphorical sense, they are going to be blessed just as you are blessed. Well, Paul is going to explain what is this metaphorical sense of being in Abraham? What constitutes that? What makes that a reality? And he's going to say, well, it's having the same belief that Abraham did. If I imitate Abraham's belief, if I imitate Abraham's receptivity to the promises of God, and I have a similar receptivity to the promises of God, then it's as if I'm his child. I'm like father, like son. I'm imitating him in my belief, and that makes me, metaphorically speaking, a child of Abraham. That's how Paul's going to read it. That's how he's going to interpret it. Now, he doesn't know that just from Genesis 12:3 alone. He has to get there by looking at other passages, and we'll spell that out as we go here. Okay, but you can see why that's going to be so important to Paul's argument. All the families of the earth are going to be blessed with eternal life, the same blessing that Abraham is going to get, simply by being in Abraham. Well, all the families of the earth are like Gentiles. So Gentiles can get in on this simply by imitating the belief of Abraham. So Paul's going to land on that really hard, because that's directly relevant to the point at issue in Galatians. Okay, I want to go to the next passage, but let me pause briefly for any, clear up any confusion or any questions on how I'm taking Genesis 12. No? Okay. So now we go to Genesis 15, and this is the verse that he quotes is in this Genesis 15, this 15 passage. I'm going to look at 1 through 6. So years have passed. God made that promise to Abraham, and Abraham's still childless, no children. It's going to be hard to be the origin and ethnic group that's going to be a great nation when you're childless. So that presents an incredibly difficult problem, and that's what's being addressed here in Genesis 15. After these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Do not fear, Abram. I am a shield to you. Your reward shall be very great." He's basically underlining the fact that this promise to him was still valid. Abraham said, "O Lord, Yahweh, what will you give me since I am childless, and the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus?" And Abram said, "Since you have given no offspring to me, one born in my house is my heir." Then behold, the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, "This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body. He shall be your heir." And he took him outside and said, "Now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your descendants be." Then he believed in Yahweh, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. Okay, that's the one that Paul quotes. I translate it differently, but that's the one that he quotes. Okay, very, very simply, there's this problem. You're going to make me a great nation, and I don't even have a single child. Don't worry, got your back. I'll take care of it. Abraham has an idea. Well, maybe it's just somebody maybe it's just a relative of mine who is going to be the beginning of this great nation that you're talking about. Yahweh comes to him and makes it clear, no, it's not going to be a relative of yours. It's going to be a child coming from your own body that's going to be the beginning of this ethnic group about which I'm making these promises. So he takes him outside and says, I'm going to make you into a great nation that is so vast that counting the people in that great nation will be as impossible as counting the stars. That's how vast I'm going to grow you, of a nation I'm going to grow you into. Abram responds. He responds in belief. And you just have this comment. He believed Yahweh, and I think the idea in both the Greek and Hebrew is, and Yahweh counted it. He journaled it. He logged it. He put it in the books. He credited it to Abram. Not as righteousness. He credited it to him, period. Now, what was the result? What was the upshot of that being credited to Abraham? It resulted in dikaiosune. Now, we've talked about dikaiosune in the past, so forgive me for reviewing this, but it's a very important concept in Paul, in all of his writings. Dikaiosune is simply being in a position where instead of the judge giving you the penalty that is your due, he is instead going to overlook the penalty that is your due and is instead going to give you the reward that you don't deserve, in this case, the blessing that you do not deserve. So Abraham is promised a blessing. Does he deserve that blessing? No, he doesn't deserve that blessing, but God has promised he's going to give it to him. So what is it that was counted such that God decided to give him the blessing that was not his due, put him in a state of dikaiosune, where God pardons or overlooks or does not remember his moral depravity and his moral unworthiness? What puts him in that state? God simply deciding to do that in response to the fact that Abraham believed. Okay. Now, here's the question. This is a weird statement in Genesis, right? Yeah, if you stop and think about it, how did the author of Genesis know? Whoever's writing this account, how did he know? Was he there? Did God tell him? I mean, what? And Abraham believed God? How does he even know that he believed God? First, how does he know he believed him? And then how does he know what exactly God's response was? Well, I don't think he's giving us an eyewitness account, nor is he giving us some kind of supernatural insight into what's going on there. He's anticipating where the account goes from here. So let's read on. And he said to him, I am Yahweh who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. He said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat and a 3-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him and cut them in two and laid each half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. The birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. Then in the fourth generation, they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch, which passed between these pieces. On that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram. And this is the key. On that day, Yahweh made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite and the Kenizzite and the Kadmonite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Rephaim and the Amorite and the Canaanite and the Girgashite and the Jebusite. Okay, he lays out the GPS coordinates on this land that he's giving him in a covenant. And the covenant, as I think David explained when he was going through here, that there's a lot of people think that that was a way that you sealed a covenant in the ancient world. You took animals, cut them in half, separated them, and the partners to the covenant walked between them. In this case, it's God in a theophany, in the form of a smoking oven and a flaming torch, but that's Yahweh appearing in that form, walking between these cut animals. Well, what is that signifying, or what does that mean? He's making an unbreakable promise to Abram. Okay. Given that that occurred, I think the author of Genesis is inferring from the fact that God immediately makes a covenant with Abraham, he's asking himself the question, why would he make a covenant with Abraham? Ah, Abraham must have believed the promise that God delivered to him. That's why he turned around immediately and made a covenant with him. Because Abraham had demonstrated who he was in his response to God. And God counted that, God reckoned that act of belief on Abraham's part, and therefore decided that he was going to bless him, forget all of his sins and depravity and unworthiness, set that aside, and bless him with the blessing that he had told him he was going to bless him with from the very get-go. And so, in response to how Abraham responded, God seals it with a covenant. We're going to see that happen again in Abraham's life a little bit later with his sacrifice of Isaac. What we have often been misled by Bible teachers, I know I was misled by Bible teachers, in the assertion that these promises are unconditional promises. They're not unconditional promises. There's no way to understand the Abraham account and think that God is promising him something unconditionally. We're going to get to the Isaac account in a second, and he's going to say, because you obeyed my voice, I will give you these things. You're doing these, my blessing you in the way I'm going to bless you was conditioned on you being a certain kind of person. Because you have demonstrated that you are a certain kind of person with a certain kind of heart, I'm going to bless you just like I said I'm going to bless you. So these are not unconditional, they're conditional. I think what those Bible teachers are trying to say when they say they're unconditional, what they're trying to say is, this is going to happen. It absolutely is going to take place exactly the way God said it's going to take place. It's not contingent on anything. But there's a difference between being contingent and being conditional. It's not contingent because it necessarily is going to take place exactly as God predicted it's going to take place. If God from the get-go said, I'm going to make you a great nation and I'm going to bless you and I'm going to make your name great, then that's exactly what's going to happen. Nothing is going to stop it from happening. But does that mean Abraham can be an unbeliever and it will take place? No, it doesn't mean that. But it just means that Abraham is not going to be an unbeliever. Abraham is going to be a believer. He's going to have to be a believer because that's the condition that is going to have to be met in order for God to impart the blessing to him. So God's word is necessarily inviolable. His promises are inviolable. That's true. But that doesn't make him unconditional. The condition must be met, and the condition will be met. By God, the condition will be met. And Abraham, sure enough, in his history, met the condition that needed to be met. He believed God. He didn't rebuff God and reject his promises. He believed God's promises. Okay. Let me do Genesis 22, and then I'll give you a chance for questions again. You know the story. Isaac, the child of his own body, the promised son, is born against all odds, supernaturally. It's a miracle that this child comes into existence. Isaac is born. He gets to be 10, 12, 14, something like that. And God comes along to Abraham and says, I want you to make an offering. And actually, I want you to make an offering of Isaac. Go up to the mountain that I will show to you and offer up Isaac as a sacrifice to me. And Abraham gulps, and does it. It goes through the motions of being obedient, right up to the point of having the knife ready to stab Isaac to death on the altar as he's bound on the altar. And Yahweh stops his hand and says, just kidding, there's a ram over there. Offer me that ram. And then here's the critical passage here. Then the angel of the Lord, of Yahweh, and remember, an angel of Yahweh is just Yahweh. It's a manifestation, some kind of auditory, some sort of sensory manifestation of Yahweh. That's an angelos of Yahweh. Then the angelos of Yahweh called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares Yahweh, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you. And I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. By the way, that's a commentary on what he means by a great nation. They will possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. Okay, so notice how clearly he treats it as conditional. Because you have met the condition, I am going to bless you. Now, what does he say? Because you've met the condition, what? He doesn't promise him anything here that he hasn't promised him two or three times already. I mean, actually, when we go back to Genesis 12, he's using different language, but if you unpack what he's promising him, he's promising him exactly the same thing he promised him back in at the very beginning in Genesis 12. I'm going to make you a great nation, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make your name great. And then he spells that out, elaborates on that in the same way that he elaborated on it in Genesis 15, but it's the same promise or same set of promises. So this isn't something new. He's just saying, you know, when I promised you all that, I really am going to do it. But as the author of Hebrews points out in his argument, notice in 16, and said, by myself I have sworn, declares Yahweh, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and so on. Now God is upping the certainty. Not only am I promising this, but I'm swearing with an oath that I will do what I said I will do. And why is he sealing it with an oath? Because he was willing to offer up his son. Now, that has troubled, that whole passage has troubled many people throughout the ages a lot. On the one hand, James uses that as an example of how you have to obey. It's not enough to just make an empty claim that you believe something. You can't just assert that you believe something. You have to actually do something that is consistent with your claim to believe, like Abraham did. So Abraham uses it as an example of works that follow logically and naturally out of the belief that you claim that you have. So he's seeing it somehow here that Abraham has a belief and his willingness to offer Isaac is somehow arising out of that belief. The author of Hebrews uses it as an example of faith in chapter 11 of Hebrews. Well, it escaped me for a long time. How is this an act of faith? I mean, how does this arise out of what you believe? But I think when we put it in the context, it becomes clear. In any other context, it would make no sense to see killing your son as an act of faith. That would make no sense at all. But in this context, I think what we have to understand is the test was, Abraham, do you have the freedom to kill your son? To obey me in the sense of killing your son. It's crucial that it's killing his son. The test makes no sense if you remove that part. It's not, do you have the faith to obey me, where the obedience is, you know, move to St. Louis. The issue is not just obedience for the sake of obedience. The issue is getting rid of your son. Will you obey me in getting rid of your son? Now, why is that such a test? Because getting rid of his son takes him right back to ground zero, puts him right back in the same place he was when he was childless. It is not possible for these promises that you made to come true if I don't have a descendant, if I don't have a son to be my heir. It's not possible. You're asking me to make it once again impossible for those promises to come true? The only person who would possibly follow God's instructions and kill his son, thereby making it impossible for God's promises to be kept, is someone who is dead sure that God would do it anyway. If God said he's going to do it, he's going to do it. If Isaac is not around to be my descendant, then, well, God's got a problem, doesn't he? But it's his problem. All I know is he promised me and he's going to do it. So that gave him the freedom to go ahead and do exactly as God said. Nobody who wants the reward, the blessing, the promise to come true, is going to follow God's instructions here unless they believe that God is a God of his word and that God will do exactly what he said he's going to do. That's the faith that the New Testament authors see operative in Abraham. And apparently the faith that God is responding to when he said, okay, I'm going to seal this promise with an oath because you have done what I said, ask you to do. I have sworn. Now, on the surface, it may sound like he's saying, because you've obeyed me, I'm going to give you the blessing. No, it's not really because you obeyed me. You did obey me, but it's because you were willing to you were willing to put yourself in a position where you could no longer see how it was even possible for my promises to come true, because you were willing to live there again. Then I seal my promise with an oath, because your faith is real. Your faith is authentic. Okay. Questions on either chapter 15 or chapter 22?
Jack, I have a question on your conditional, the promise of God being conditional.
Okay.
I guess I've always thought that one thing I can rely on with absolute certainty are the promises of God.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that, but you were saying, if I understood it correctly, that the promise that he made to Abraham wasn't unconditional, it was conditional.
Right.
And it seems like we're kind of in the same situation as, from God's perspective, being a divine determinist versus my position being free will. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So can you clear that up? Or I see the one fairly clearly, but not the God's promises that they're conditional.
Okay.
To Abraham. You understand what I'm...
I think so. Let me
And does that also apply to other conditions of... Well, I guess it would. God's promises of eternal life are...
They're conditional.
Are conditional, yeah. Very definitely.
Right.
But so, yeah, I was just kind of surprised that, yeah, so...
Yeah, all the important promises in the Bible are conditional. Are there unconditional promises? There might be. I haven't thought about it, but all the important promises in the Bible are conditional. If you do this, then this will be the result. Then this will be done to you, or this will be given to you, or whatever. Yeah, I suppose that. See, if you have the perspective that I have, that God is the sovereign author of all of reality, He's a transcendent author who makes everything happen, including your choices, then none of this is a problem. Because God can make something conditional on what you choose and still be absolutely certain that it's going to happen, and can make a promise that it's going to happen. Because your having to make the right choice in order for it to happen is no obstacle to God. He's just going to reach into your heart and tweak your willer and make your willer make the right choice. So it becomes problematic for people who don't have that view of God, where God doesn't really have access to my choices. Then in their worldview, if you make it conditional, then somehow my not choosing right could thwart God's purposes and actually sabotage the very result that God promised would be the result. And they just, you know, they just can't put that together. But it shouldn't be a problem to anyone who believes in the transcendent author of all reality, who's in control of every square inch and iota and nanosecond of reality and exactly what transpires there. That's no problem to him. Okay. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm remembering, I think, in the Hebrews passage, is there a comment about Abraham believing God could raise the dead, and that figured into his calculations?
Yeah, yeah, there is a parenthetical comment. He believed that if necessary, God could raise him from the dead. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Had God already made it clear by that point that Isaac, as an individual, was the child he had promised, or do you know if he... Because it seems like the resurrection comment would be pretty important at that point.
Correct me, some of you, but I'm almost certain that that's true, yeah.
So all the subsequent aspects that play out after the Abrahamic covenant that relate to it, like there would be a king... Mm-hmm. That Christ would be on David's throne, and that they would always possess the land. Are you saying that all those are conditioned on Israel's continued obedience?
Yeah.
Or were they all placed by that one act of belief on Abraham?
They are clearly conditional on Israel's obedience. That's the whole structure of the Mosaic covenant. Do these things, and I will bless you in this way. Remember the passage I cited out of Deuteronomy. If you do these things, you will be the head, and they will be the tail. You will be that great nation. Don't do these things, and you will be the tail and they will be the head. It's conditioned on whether you keep these commandments or not. Is Israel going to keep those commandments? They are. In the day when it matters, in the day when God comes along to that generation of Jews who are going to realize the promise that God is making to Abraham. Why will they realize the promise that God is making to Abraham? Because they're going to keep the commandments. They're going to keep the covenant in that day. They're going to be led by Jesus the Messiah into a righteous obedience to God's covenant.
It seems like they're not really making the choice, though, speaking of free will or whatnot. So it sounds as though you're saying that God will force, he foresees that they will, but in reality, he's going to make them make that choice.
What's your favorite fictional story?
Wow.
You don't
so
do,
many.
You don't do fiction.
My life.
That's gonna. It's not gonna work.
Let's see.
I mean, just imagine a character in a story. Are the characters in the story not really making the choices that they're really making?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there.
Okay. I think we're in exactly the same kind of relationship to God. Of course I'm making my choices. Nobody else is making them. I'm making them. Mm-hmm. They're my choices coming out of my will. I'm the one who deliberates and sweats and gets anxious and worries about what choice I should make. It's my choice. It belongs to me. And the choice I make reflects on who I am. It's my choice. But I have a creator. And the creator is the one who's, you know, I'm not a wind-up doll. Creation is not him, you know, sticking me down, winding me up, and letting me go. I am, every nanosecond of my life is being created by the author of my being. In him I live and move and have my existence, in him. So the author is willing every element of my being and every aspect of my experience. It's being created by God. So my choices are part of what God is creating. So in one sense, yes, I don't have a choice. I don't have a choice like our secular culture likes to tell me I have choices. That I'm completely on my own, autonomous from any creator, and my creator is completely, if I even believe in a creator, is hands off and has nothing to do with me. I'm the creator of my own life and experience. Not from a biblical perspective. No, you're not. Every bit of who you are is being created by God constantly. So are any of us autonomous from God, independent of our Creator? Absolutely not. So in that sense, I'm not free. I'm not free from my Creator. To be free from my Creator would be to be non-existent. It's the only way to be free from a Creator, is to not even be there.
I can go along with that. I believe that too. But I think when we categorize things as conditional or unconditional, as we look at those covenants, they appear to be unconditional because God says this is going to happen regardless.
Okay, now stay with me here. It's the word I'm picking on. Do they appear to be necessary, absolutely certain, going to happen, nothing's going to stop it? Absolutely. That's how he's presenting them. This is going to happen. It's necessary. Nothing is going to keep it from happening. It can't not happen because God said it's going to happen. I think that's what you're wanting to call unconditional. You're absolutely right about that. They all have that character to them. But that's not what unconditional means. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. To be conditional simply means if X, then Y. If you do this, then this will be given to you. Does it have that structure to it? Actually, yes, it does. If Abraham believes God, then God will make him a great nation, will bless him, and will make his name great. If Abraham flips God off, it ain't going to happen. But is Abraham going to flip God off? No, he's not. Because the creator of Abraham's being is creating Abraham to be a believer, not a rebel. So is there any doubt but what God's promises to Abraham are going to come about? No doubt at all. Absolutely no doubt. Because God's going to make Abraham into the person who meets exactly those conditions that would lead to God wanting to bless him in exactly the way he promises that he's going to do.
So clear up then that visual of him placing the meat. Mm-hmm. And the way I was taught or understood was both parties of the covenant would pass between the meat, between the offering. Mm-hmm. And the fact that only God passed through it as our visual example would be, signified that it's a covenant that God is making that is unbreakable.
Yeah, I think what the unilateral nature of the covenant is doing is emphasizing how unbreakable it is. It doesn't make it unconditional, but it's saying this is unbreakable. From my part, I'm going to do what it takes to make sure this happens. God speaking, Yahweh speaking. I absolutely am going to make this happen. You see the same thing in Genesis 22 with Isaac. By myself, I swear, this is what I will do. He's taking an oath. Not only have I promised this, but I swear I'm going to do what I promised. Well, you know, he's upping the certainty level. But what he's emphasizing, still, he's not making it unconditional, but he's making it absolutely certain. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, this is what I'm going to do, and this is what's going to happen. So all of our instincts about that are right. I just think we want to be more careful in the language we use to describe that, because I just remember early on as a child looking at the people saying this is an unconditional promise, and then I would read something like, because you have obeyed me, this is happening. Sounds conditional to me. Why is it unconditional? And it was just because I had been misled, because somebody had mislabeled what was going on with the promise. No, it wasn't unconditional, but it's absolutely certain and unbreakable and necessary, and it is going to happen, and ain't nothing going to stop it. Whatever word you want to use for that, it is that. You know?
Okay, just one last thing, then I'll leave it alone. But so he's preserved Israel, a remnant, as a nation, mm-hmm. even though they've been disobedient and not performed to the covenant.
So. Right, absolutely. Okay. I mean, that's a big deal to the prophets. If they had become like Sodom and Gomorrah, then God never would have kept his promises. There's no ethnic group left to be a great nation. So for that reason, because he had made that promise to Abraham, he always kept a remnant. And the day is going to come where they will be the predominant nation on the earth.
Okay. Can you make explicit the logic of God? Because in the first instance, he comes and he says, here are your three promises. And then in the second instance, it's, I'm testing you on the ethnic thing. And in the second instance, I'm testing you on the ethnic thing. Right? Like, Isaac is the one through whom you're going to have these descendants, as many of the stars, et cetera, et cetera. So why do the other two promises apply, even though both testings are only with regard to, does that question make sense?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I don't think it's because there's any logical connection between the three promises, but they come in the same contract. So the initial contract has all three elements of that. So when he tests them on that, I think the assumption is simply that if you believe the one, you believe the whole package. If you believe the one, it's because you believe the original contract, if you will, to begin with, the original promise to begin with. So, yeah, I mean, and you, yeah. It would be kind of funky for God to come to Abraham in Genesis 15. Well, yeah, I believe I am going to have a son, but I'm not so sure about you blessing me, that part of it, and all the earth being blessed in me. I don't buy that part. I mean, it stands to reason that the same belief that is willing to believe the one impossible thing is quite willing to believe the other things. There's no reason to think those are impossible. Well, I guess, yeah, apart from having to believe in resurrection, there's no reason to believe that those are impossible in the same way that the first one is.
So how come then, because ostensibly Paul is going to separate the third one off, because that's the one we care about, because we're from all the other families.
Mm-hmm.
If they're all part of the same contract, why aren't they all a package deal? Like, why don't you have to be part of the great nation? Like, does that, like, how can you, on the one hand, they all function because they're part of the same thing.
Yes.
But on the other hand, only one of them matters, even though they're part of the...
Well, no, I think they all matter. I'm not convinced that we're not part of the great nation. Because, and I don't know. I mean, that's a question I have. But when Jesus returns, I'm going to be resurrected to ostensibly reign with him. I think my reign with him does make me a member of that great nation that is going to have ascendancy in the earth.
So why does it make sense to separate in you all of the families that are not part of your family will be blessed by your family? If all the not family people get blessed by the family people, but we are part of the family, then how does?
Well, it's because we have to understand what's the mechanism that makes us part of the family. It's not biology. It's not normal biological and ethnic. It's not how people normally find their ethnic identity. It's this weird thing where I identify with the faith of the patriarch of that family, and that makes me a part of that family. That's just such a weird, different, odd, unusual way to connect me to the family that I think that's what he's getting at.
I think I'm following and agreeing with what you're saying about unconditionality, contingency, and all of that.
I'm sorry, about what?
I think I'm following what you're saying about like unconditionality and contingency and all of that. My conception of the gospel that Paul is saying, so this would be great if you could clear this up if it's a misconception right now, is because you said something about one day Israel will meet the condition and then that is when God will bless them. Is that how you were thinking about that?
Right, right.
So my understanding has been that what Paul is saying is, while you were still in your sins, the Messiah died for you. That mm-hmm. there's something about that is, look at the depths of the mercy of God. He didn't wait for you to meet the condition. He was so faithful to his promises, to those who believe in him, that he's making this happen before we got our act together. Before we got to the point where we were following the law as well as we should have been doing this whole time. Before mm-hmm. any of that happened, he showed mercy to us. Is that part of how you're seeing it? So that all of those blessings then that come with the Abrahamic promise that the prophets are pointing ahead to, there's a sense in which those are set now. Those are in stone. Actually, there's no condition in the way you're meaning it anymore for them to meet. God's going to make it happen. he's already started making it happen, something like that.
Why is there no condition? I'm not sure I'm following you.
Because of what Jesus did, that has sort of erased the condition. The curse of the law is gone. It's just the blessing remains for God to bring about in his own time.
Yeah, that's not where my theology goes. That's not my understanding of Paul. I think Jesus' death on the cross for the non-believer did diddly squat. It didn't accomplish anything. Mm-hmm. It becomes the basis upon which it becomes a touchstone for the rest of mankind to decide who are we. If we identify with what the Messiah has done on our behalf on the cross, then we become children of Abraham. That's what he's arguing in Galatians. Then we become children of Abraham. If we don't identify with that, we are not children of Abraham. And his dying on the cross for me didn't do diddly squat for me.
I'm agreeing with that.
Okay.
Yeah. I think what it is that the condition is not getting our act together and keeping the law, and then God will bring the blessing.
Yes, but it doesn't make it unconditional. It's just that the condition changes, and that's what the whole argument of Galatians is about.
I see.
Is the condition if you keep the law, you will receive the blessing of Abraham? No. The condition is if you believe in Jesus, you will receive the blessing of Abraham.
Okay.
That's exactly the pointed issue in this passage that we're going to enter into. What's the ultimate condition that God has always had in mind for identifying who is going to be a child of Abraham and receive the blessing of Abraham?
I think we're on the same page, and I think I misunderstood you, because I heard you to be saying one day the Jews will keep the law, and that's when God is going to bring all those blessings. And I wouldn't even really quibble with one day they're going to keep the law, as that is something that will happen. It just sounded like you were saying when they meet that condition, when the blessing comes.
I see the confusion, yeah. There's two conditions that they will and must meet in order to have the promises of the Mosaic covenant. One, they must keep the law, and two, they must believe in Jesus.
Now I'm confused.
They're going to have to meet both conditions, because I don't have a promise to me that if I believe in Jesus, God will make me into a great nation. That's really embodied in the Mosaic covenant, where that gets spelled out. What's the condition that you must meet in order for that promise to Abraham to get met? It has everything to do with keeping the covenant that God made, that unique covenant that he made with Israel as a people at Sinai. They can't shine that on and expect to receive the promises that were attached to that covenant. So that's why in the end they're going to be keeping the Mosaic covenant, because their greatness as a nation in the land and protected in the land is contingent on that. And that's what Jesus, their Lord and Messiah, will instruct them to do give them the example of, is we must honor God by keeping the covenant that he made with us.
I think I see where you're coming from.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, I have to let you go. We'll look at some more Old Testament passages next week.